Excuse me. Crazy
Love. So that is Love Sounds. Love Sounds. Love is a many razor bladed things from Doopy Time. Pretty fun album. And the song before that was another classic album. It's a Sylvan Screen by the Olivet Tremor Control from Black Foliage Animation Music. And the last one here, hope you enjoy what you listened to so far. On WCD.org, we have the songs in our set list. And the last song is an electronic one, Tsurama by Masakatsu Takagi from the album World is So Beautiful.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
If a person's a first-time home buyer, want to buy a home, the first thing you want to do, remember I mentioned education is so important, and that's why going to these home buyer workshops, you learn about special purpose credit programs, and yes, you should ask. Always ask what programs are out there. The banks are regulated to let you know the programs that are out there, you know, and then making sure you know what type of loan you're getting, an FHA or a conventional loan. So that's why going backwards, really doing your homework first, taking not just one home buyer workshop, taking several and comparing them. So when you go to that lender that's sitting across the table from you, that loan officer should be able to give you, number one, programs that are available. Secondly, provide for you a plan and not just steer you in one direction.
Lilia Pope, president of the National Association of Real Estate Brokers. In 1974, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act allowed the establishment of special purpose credit programs by nonprofit and for-profit organizations to meet the unique credit needs of borrowers. In 2021, HUB released guidance saying the SPCPs can legally be developed by nonprofit and for-profit financial institutions to help resolve barriers faced by economically disadvantaged groups such as African Americans, Hispanic, and women when they seek to purchase a home. According to Pope, America has a low rate of home ownership among African American families because of the overt racism in government and private sector practices and policies that limit the building of intergenerational wealth. SPCPs provide opportunities to balance the scale and put more African Americans on a path towards building wealth through home ownership. I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the National Association of Real Estate Brokers with President Lydia Pope in Black America.
On behalf of NARAB, our whole purpose focusing on democracy and housing and Black home ownership is just to make sure we change this wealth gap. But it's going to take everyone within the communities to come together, to talk to your realtors members. Let us be a voice in your city to talk about Black home ownership and stop the redlining and stop the discrimination and allow us to be as Blacks to be able to find places wherever that they want to find places. But this is important for us as a Black organization to make sure that we're doing that. We can't. Congress and policy is different, so it's harder to get policies approved, and they take longer. But instant items such as community efforts, talking to your council folks, and letting us be that voice is a big start for us.
In 1947, the National Association of Real Estate Brokers, Inc. was founded in Tampa, Florida, as an equal opportunity civil rights advocacy organization for African-American real estate professionals, consumers, and communities in America. The purpose of NAREB is to enhance the economic improvement of its members, the community at large, and the minority community which it serves. Before and after World War II, a series of government programs provided opportunity for white families to purchase home and build wealth, resulting in a housing boom that created the modern suburbs surrounding major cities across this country. But African Americans were not allowed to participate in these programs, and the private sector, as well as the government, engaged in redlining to relegate African Americans to segregated neighborhoods. Recently in Black America, spoke with Lydia Pope, president of NAREB, regarding a program that assists African Americans in home ownership.
Yes, born and raised in the city of Cleveland, Ohio, and been doing real estate for over, now we're probably talking almost 30 years.
For our audience that haven't heard of the National Association of Real Estate Brokers, Inc., tell us about the organization.
The National Association of Real Estate Brokers, known as NARAB, we call ourselves Realtists, been around for over 75 years. Back in 1947, when the organization was originated, it was only because the National Association of Realtors would not allow access to Blacks to be able to sell properties and be a part of their organization. And so we formed our own, which is the National Association of Real Estate Brokers. Even today, though, all of the groups, we get along pretty good. We work together on different initiatives, but that was the original reason why NARAB was formulated. It was all about democracy and housing and just making sure that Black Americans can be able to own a home anywhere they want in the country.
So what sparked that initial interest in real estate?
Well, in real estate, my parents owned a home, and when I was renting a property, just decided that, you know, my parents have been raised in a single home my entire life, And before my father passed away, the main thing he talked about is only land and real estate. We were the first black on the street in Cleveland, Ohio, lived off of 106 in Union for those who are in the city. And that was an urban area. And so, but yeah, by us being that, home ownership was very important. So I wanted to make sure that we sustained that. In addition to that, that home today, my brother owns it. So it's about generational wealth, keeping the property in the family and building that wealth legacy. So that's what got me into real estate. Wanted to really own a home, try to buy a home, was discriminated against. I didn't know what discrimination was back then. So rather than, rather than try to fight a different way, I went and got my real estate license.
I understand you've been in the business since 1995. What changes have you seen thus far, good or bad?
Well, the changes, honestly, the changes have not been any different. The redlining still is there. The racial discrimination disparity is still there. Minorities buying property when it comes to loans and mortgages is still the same. Even though the rates are going up and down, we're just talking about racial inequity. And from that, my experience in real estate, that same pattern is still existing today.
As you mentioned earlier, what have you seen to make it so difficult, particularly from an industry standpoint, for African Americans to have home ownership?
Well, you know, in my real estate career, the years I've been in this business, it's been very difficult. I do own my own company. I own two real estate companies. However, though, the struggle to be able to sell properties in areas that are predominantly white has not been the easiest. And it's not all real estate related. Sometimes it's community related. What's happening within the community, embracing other ethnicities into the neighborhood. So throughout my 20 plus years, I've experienced the discrimination. I experienced where they wouldn't let us in a property because we were black. I discriminated when the police was called on us when I was trying to get into a property, in Ohio. So I've had all those experiences, which have really allowed me as president, not just to be able to focus on democracy and housing and advocate, but my personal experience, bringing that in, understand what folks go through when they go through that phase of trying to buy a home and you can't get in.
Speaking of trying to buy a home, what are some of the processes? And we're going to get through some of the programs that we want to touch on during this conversation. But the process of first thinking about buying a home and then going through that purchase process.
So, when you're buying a home and going through the purchase process, whether you're black or not, you just want to make sure, number one, it's about your credit. And so focusing and knowing what your credit score is, understanding that, and then just not going right to the real estate agent and say, hey, I want to buy a home, show me a house, get me a loan. The education is the primary focus before you even go into that venture. A lack of education can deter you into a different pattern, which you may end up being a victim of loan level pricing. That means price higher. You may be a victim of buying property that you could have had a better understanding of it and negotiating. So the home buyer workshops, working with a HUD approved housing counselor, to me is one of the best steps, the first step a person would want to do before they jump into this field. So when you walk in there, you're walking in with a pre-approval certificate, you're walking in with credit ready, you're walking in with understanding all the down payment programs, and you become better informed. So when someone's talking with you, you articulate and understand what that agent or loan officer is speaking about.
How do we get to this point in history that is so inequitable between African-American homeowners and white homeowners as the valuation of their property if they're similar?
Well, discrimination goes back, it goes back, of course, over 100 plus years. It goes back centuries. With discrimination. And so when you're in a neighborhood that's predominantly black or all black, and then an appraiser comes to appraise a property that is non-black because they don't understand the neighborhood. And I don't understand, and I get what the appraiser stated when it comes to, well, everything is in black and white. It's written. No, there's some underlining discriminative practices when information is being input into the appraisal system. So it's just not all about, the appraisal saying we put the numbers in and this is what you get out. That's inaccurate. It's a little bit more deeper into that. Humans put in the information and the information is being spit out a certain direction. So when you're buying a house in a neighborhood or you live in a neighborhood and going back hundreds of years as African American, you know, we're talking about discrimination from the beginning of history. You know, so it's just not in homes. You know, it's in the neighborhoods, the color of your skin. So when you start there, then the redlining, the block busting has always been a part of the history of this, of our culture. So moving forward, if I fast forward this, here we are in 2023, and we still have the same issues. Some have been revealed and elevated. Some are just now kind of undercover, but it still exists. And it's a problematic challenge that we as African Americans need to learn, are working through this process, but we need the help of Congress. We need the help of our policyholders, you know, to be able to work through this discriminative and this redlining to get us into a space where we can be able to increase that Black home ownership rate.
Does it make a difference, the ethnicity of the appraiser?
Well, 1%, a little over 1% of America are Black appraisers. And so when you're talking appraising, to answer your question, yes. Mm. When you're dealing with your appraising, when over 99% of that are either white or other, but they're not Black, it makes it very difficult for someone to be able to understand the culture and the neighborhood that you live in. You know, it's ironic that I remember when we were sitting at the table with our Secretary of HUD, Marsha Fudge, mm-hmm. and how she kind of told her story and her experience on being discriminative when it comes to the appraisal value. And her house is right across the street right across the street, and her house appraised less than what the house across the street appraised. And so, you know, so when you're dealing with neighborhoods and its equity value, because it was stripped years and decades ago, and then you try to bring in the appraisers that are not familiar with some of the cultures that can look a little deeper to assist with the appraisal process, you know, then that makes it a big difference. And you got to remember, if 1% are Black, and I'm not saying all 99% are against Black, there are some that are and some that are not. The ones that are against Blacks and prejudice, now we got to deal with that issue going down the line in appraising. So when they go to, you know, a white house, they, you know, they'll be able to appraise it higher. It can be the same house, but because it's white owned, it does make a difference. And that has been proven in Black and white throughout the state, throughout the country. It's so many stories in regards to that are truly valid. So sometimes it's the people and not so much the program.
I understand. You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson, Jr. We'll be back with more of our conversation in just a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Lydia Pope, the 32nd president of the National Association of Real Estate Brokers. Ms. Pope, talk to us about the Special Purpose Credit Program.
Special Purpose Credit Program. Now, this program has been around since 1974. It's been around for a long time. And so I'm happy to see that this program is beginning to become elevated. Mm-hmm. So this program on special purpose program, the purpose of this, and it's not for Blacks, it's for economically disadvantaged groups, which includes Blacks. And so what it does, the special purpose credit program legally can develop it to the financial institution to provide different down payment assistance and programs for disadvantaged groups so they can have that would accept the lower credit score, the lower down payment. And again, this has been going on for quite so many years, but not utilized by the banking industry. And we're now just talking about it. You know, back in 74, with the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, it allowed the establishment of the special purpose credit program to do its proper needs to the borrowers. But again, it has not been elevated or accessed all these many years. So and to NARAB, this is very important to us, and we have adopted this process because what it does is starting to widen the gap between Black home ownership and white home ownership. And so even with NARAB in 2021, the nation, we experienced our largest home ownership spread since 1890. Since 1890, Blacks have experienced the largest home ownership spread at 44.6%. We've always been about a 30% gap. So it shows that it's a start for us to be able to work within our communities that we're serving with lower credit scores that are still good borrowers with good credit. Your scores might be lower. It doesn't mean you have bad credit, but this gives them programs and assistance.
I guess the $100,000 question is, why aren't mortgage companies using this program?
Well, that's a question that was that with NARAB that we've been putting our stamp on the banks that are doing the special purpose credit programs. You know, the banks are regulated through the CRA, Community Reinvestment Act, to provide programmatics for low to moderate income families in disadvantaged areas. Some have accepted a special purpose credit program, some have not. But I am seeing a lot of the major banks are getting on board and getting on the bandwagon to work through this program to be able to be a catalyst in increasing the Black home ownership. But there's no, I don't know the reason why, but our goal and hope as an organization that we continue to voice our concerns where we're at to get the other banks on board.
I guess the next obvious question is for those who are anticipating on purchasing a home that happens to listen to this program, and could they go in and suggest to the mortgage lenders that this program is available and to see if they may qualify?
Absolutely. You know, if you're a first-time home buyer, if a person's a first-time home buyer, want to buy a home, and the first thing you want to do, remember I mentioned education is so important, and that's why going to these home buyer workshops, you learn about special purpose credit program, and yes, you should ask. Always ask what programs are out there. The banks are regulated to let you know the programs that are out there, you know, and then making sure you know what type of loan you're getting, an FHA or a conventional loan. So that's why going backwards, really doing your homework first, taking not just one home buyer workshop, taking several and comparing them. So when you go to that lender that's sitting across the table from you, that loan officer should be able to give you, number one, programs that are available.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, provide for you a plan and not just steer you in one direction. And when I was on Dr. Phil, I talked about that, how my niece, they steered her to one type of loan instead of the other. And she had the credit score. She had the down payment. So I had her pack her bags, go to the bank, and we sat in front of the bank till they changed it. And these are things that, but they didn't give her choices. And she should have had choices. And that's why I'm encouraging everyone to do their homework. Find out every kind of loan you can get, not just one.
When you talk about the home buyers workshop, where can you find out where those workshops are located or taking place?
So the best way to find out about Home Buyers Workshop is to go under the HUD.gov website. Housing counselors are regulated by the Housing and Urban Development. They're certified housing counselors, and many of them in your areas will have home buyer workshops that you can attend at no cost. Now, banks do have their home buyer workshops as well, and I always encourage just to sit in on them, again, to get the education. But using your HUD-approved counseling agencies around the country does have that. And NARAB, as part of our organization, we have an affiliate called NID, National Investment Division. That's our housing counseling component that is HUD-approved, where our counselors are out there doing counseling all around the country. And we have over, I think, 90-plus places that they can go to within the state, within your state. But you can go on the HUD.gov website or go on our NARAB site, look under NID, and you can see if there's a counseling agency in your area.
Now, you mentioned certain types of loans. What different types of loans are available for home buyers?
So a home buyer has a conventional loan. So understanding what's the difference between a conventional loan, an FHA loan, and then you have what they call an FHA 203K loan. That's a rehab loan. Many of these properties in the neighborhoods have been dilapidated. They're beautiful homes with strong bones. They just need some updates. There's rehab loans out there to assist them to add on to the value of the property so they can be able to buy the property, get the property fixed up with fix-up money from FHA, so it's a government loan, and be able to live into that property as owner-occupied. Then you have, of course, the VA loans for veterans. So these are the types of loans that a person can apply,
mm-hmm.
but you want to make sure you understand what's entailed into those loans. Like FHA is 3.5%, conventional is 5%, but sometimes that special purpose credit program we talked about that are under a CRA, Community Reinvestment Act, meaning they have to give loans out. Sometimes they have programs that will override that 5% down and provide down payment assistance so that the borrower doesn't have to come up with all those additional funds and the money they have saved. They can put that up for things that they need when they move into a home. So you want to make sure you have some reserves.
How can an individual find out a member of your organization is a realtor in their neighborhood?
So to find out about us, you go under NAREB.com. That's NAREB.com. And if you look into the top level, you'll see where to find a realtor's member. So they're on, and if you click on the state and find out where the members are in that area. There's a board just about in most of your areas, and the boards consist of real estate agents, loan officers, anyone in the real estate industry, home inspectors, appraisers, all are in that industry. You can find that out through our NAREB.com to be able to find someone in your area.
Are there any dollar credits that are associated with this special purpose credit program that we're speaking of?
It is. Every bank has their own internal processes on how much money they will be contributing towards a first-time home buyers. Some go up to $7,500 for first-time home buyers. Some are $3,000. Some are a little bit more. So it just depends on the neighborhood that you're, the bank that you're utilizing, how much money they're giving, they are giving. And let me add one point to this. When you're looking for down payment money, look for your state finance agency, because there's three pools of money: your state finance agency, your bank gives down payment assistance, and then sometimes the community that you're in gives down payment assistance. And some of those can be layered. Some of those monies can be layered. So you want to know your local and county money, your bank money, and your housing finance money, and kind of see, get the education and see what funds are out there to take advantage of all of those funds that they've been pretty much having for some time.
Before we run out of time, Ms. Poe, obviously there was an unprecedented interest rate reduction prior to what we're seeing now. How did African Americans do during that, I guess, the boom time for interest rates versus what's happening now when the interest rates are much higher?
Well, the interest rates for the black home buyer when it was real much lower about a year or so ago was much better for the African American community. We took advantage of a lot of the programs that was out there, because remember, when you have a lower interest rate, and student loans is one of the largest factors of the African American race when it comes to debt, because they go by your debt to income ratio.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have that lesser interest rate, and you match that up with the debt to income on their student loan, it still allows them to be able to afford a house. Now the rates are high, the affordability is less. And so now it is a little bit more difficult.
So in your report that the organization recently put out, what in a thumbnail, the summary of how the industry and how African Americans are doing versus their white counterparts?
Well, as of right now, that's in our State of Housing and Black America report. What it's basically stating is that the home ownership for blacks dropped nearly 20% since the last, 2 years now. In 1960, it was 38%. The difference between black and white home ownership have always been around a 30% gap. Average for white home ownership could have ranged from 65% to 74%. So you see it's a huge difference in the way African-American interest, almost 50% of that, but it's a 30% gap, but about 50% if you look at blacks versus white in home ownership. Huge difference.
Now, there's a lot of gentrification going on around the country. How important for this generation to maintain home ownerships of their parents or grandparents in the neighborhoods in which they grew up in?
So our parents bought properties in communities. They called them communities. And with gentrification, what's happening now is that the seniors are being phased out either medically or passing on, and the children are not taking advantage of the housing, or maybe don't understand the whole real estate process when it comes to generational wealth on staying in the community. You know, and because of that, we have investors that are coming in rebuilding properties at higher pricing than it's pushing out the ones that are still there. And so it's so important that as African Americans that we keep and stay in our communities. You know, we keep that generational wealth going. You know, and that's what our parents did, and that's what we should be doing, because what that allows you to do is be able to build that. My house is still that we own today that my parents own. We still own it. We're still in the community, because we find it very important to stay where the property is and prevent a lot of that of what's happening when it comes to gentrification. But the more that we don't take ownership of our community, the more gentrification is going to spread wild in all the communities that we're serving, and it makes and then pushing out our seniors and the affordability that they have in those areas, even when it comes to rental.
Final two questions, Ms. Polk. There was some, I think, unethical practices going on in 2007, 2008 with some mortgage companies, and I hate to give a mortgage company some free publicity, but what mortgage companies, in your opinion, today are doing a better job than others?
Well,
if there are any.
I think that majority of them have taken a step up the ladder. Let me say that. I've seen positive with all the negative publicity, like, you know, back then your Bank of America's, your Wells Fargo's, they've really been taking a step up the ladder to improve, you know, number one, their products. Secondly, participating in the special purpose credit program, understanding the needs of the community. And I think they heard the voices and concerns of the community. But I do see an increase in all of the banking industries taking a little bit of a step up, even your Rocket Mortgage. We're not, I think they're doing $7,500 in credits for first-time home buyers to use for closing costs. And so these are things that I'm starting to see that, you know, these Freddie and Fannie Mae lenders, such as your banking industry, to really see that they are improving because of this. And number one, their inventory, because what we find out is that with the mortgage rates going up, guess what? They're not making enough money. The banking industry is not making enough money. So they have to figure out another creative way to try to rebuild their portfolio. And the way to do this is creating some of these down payment programs.
And speaking with a good friend of mine who's in the automobile reporting business, said a lot of this generation are leasing. Are this generation of Americans, particularly African Americans, are they in the home buying mindset?
They're not. And a lot of the millennials, and that's when NARAP, we've taken a position. We have one of our pillars is our generational wealth. And we've been educating we go to the HBCUs to educate our college students about real estate and home ownership, because that's really where it starts. So once they enter into college and they leave college, they understand the whole purpose of real estate and the importance of keeping and having assets. Rather, they keep it, Airbnb it, sell it on to their family members. For owning property is one of the biggest assets and big investments in this country. And we want to make sure that our millennials are very clear that that's something that they can have, even if they move around, because at some point they may settle back and go back home to their property. At least they'll have somewhere to go.
Lydia Polk, president of the National Association of Real Estate Brokers. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
Hi, this is Kevin Amos, and you're listening to In Black America and Ebony Spectrum here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
The tragic death of Tyree Nichols, days after being brutally beaten by now former Memphis police officers, making news headlines around the world.
For national action on police reform.
I've always been curious.
Don Lemon, formerly of CNN, was one of the many journalists who descended on Memphis, and he was the first to interview Tyree's mother, Rovon Wells, establishing a heart bond with the grieving parent. But recently, that connection and others brought Lemon back to the Bluff City to speak to the Memphis chapter of the NAACP during their annual Freedom Fund Gala. Nichols' story struck a particular chord for Lemon. Like me, sons of the American South, born around the end of the Civil Rights era.
That made me curious about life, curious about how things ran, what was behind things, and about America. And so that's how I ended up becoming a journalist, just by being curious and asking questions.
We sat down before the ceremony, in Lemon's first one-on-one sit-down interview since he was fired from the anchor chair he's held at CNN for the last 17 years.
Yeah, go ahead. Rudy's going to kill you all if you don't get this interview.
Well, Lemon's not talked publicly about his departure since the infamous tweets, the social media post expressing his surprise over how things went down. Well, the news vet has since placed it all into perspective, and the question isn't so much about him being fired, but how he says a fire was ignited in him.
So, Don, you say for those concerned about your departure from CNN, it fundamentally came down to truth and responsibility?
I have a responsibility not only as a journalist, but as an American, to tell the truth and to abide by the promises of the Constitution. Because the Constitution says a more perfect union, not a perfect union. I'm not a perfect person. No one is. But I think the Constitution deserves us in order to fulfill the promise of the Constitution, we have to stand up for what is right. We have to stand up for the truth.
News to us here at CNN.
Weeks after Lemon was fired from the network, so was the network's chief executive, Chris Licht. Lemon's dismissal, seen by critics as just one of the then CEO and chairman's many missteps, spiraling the network into decline. Licht's mission? To pull news coverage back to center.
Allowed to enjoy.
Then there were tense moments on air, like this one. Lemon's pushback from GOP presidential hopeful Vivek Ramaswamy.
You are in black skin and you live in this country, then you can disagree with me, but we're not.
I don't believe in platforming liars and bigots and, insurrectionists and election deniers and putting them on the same footing as people who are telling the truth, people who are fighting for what's right, people who are abiding by the Constitution. I think that would be a dereliction of journalistic duties to do those sorts of things. That is what has gotten me to this point, and that is what is going to carry me forward.
Being true to himself is what Lemon says allows him to sleep at night.
To know that I am doing the right thing, that I am standing up and abiding by the Constitution, which my profession demands that I do, because we are listed in the First Amendment of the Constitution, which is freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and freedom of the press.
As for what lies ahead for Lemon, well, he says he's a man of faith.
I'm not going to force anything. I'm not going to let other people's timeline influence me. I know people say, I miss you on television. What is your next move? I'm figuring that out. I don't have to be in a rush. I think sometimes people rush to make decisions and they end up making the wrong decisions.
Lemon, who published his memoir, Transparent, in 2011, and This Is the Fire in 2021, says he'll spend the next several months enjoying time with his fiance, real estate agent Tim Malone, and their dogs, leaning into life.
And I'm not worried at all. People are like concerned about me and more worried about me than I am about myself. I'm fine. Someone is looking out for me.
He may no longer helm the anchor desk at CNN.
You're killing it.
I'm just being me and I'm being honest.
But Lemon is still a journalist, maintaining a strong commitment to his liberties and justice for the people, he says.
My adopted city.
As he sits in Memphis, Tennessee, he reflects on the city's significance and the contributions and sacrifices of Martin Luther King Jr., Ida B. Wells, and yes, Tyree Nichols, in the fight for truth and justice.
If we don't honor them by standing up and doing the right thing and not allowing people to legislate us out of rights and out of existence, then how are we honoring them?
In Memphis, I'm Rudy Williams.
This is Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. And I just wanted to send a quick message to you today. Very excited about the fact that we finally are not only finished with the State of the Black World Conference about 2 months ago now, but that we have the Baltimore Declaration out. Coming to you on Juneteenth, just finished my radio program. That's right, I have a radio show, if you didn't know about it. It comes out every Monday. It's called Vantage Point. It's on WBAI 99.5 FM. That's on the Pacifica Network. We come on at 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock p.m. And we had a great discussion about Juneteenth today, but we opened the phones up and people called, and I was delighted to hear people who had attended the conference, and they were so happy and thrilled and encouraged and inspired by it. It was just very rewarding. So in case you missed the Baltimore Declaration, because that's what they were responding to, that they had received the Baltimore Declaration, they had read it, they lacked the fact that it's action oriented, it's an agenda that we can begin to work on and whatnot. So in case you missed it, we're sending it out again today. And we hope that you'll read it. Again, the Baltimore Declaration, open it up. There are about 14 or 15 different issue items and areas of work, the special initiatives, beautiful graphics and images. And then you can go and explore the photo gallery of different scenes from the conference and everything. Because if you didn't come, I'm sure you wish you had attended. But the most important thing is you can also support what we're doing. So I hope that you'll both review and look at the Baltimore Declaration and say, I'd like to be a friend of IBW. We're creating a category called Friends of IBW. So perhaps once you've finished it, you will in fact decide to enroll in or become a friend of IBW. So enjoy.
Hey y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm gonna keep it black. But I'ma keep it brief. Mayday! Mayday! We is under attack! The aliens? No, girl, the whites. Oh, girl. And right here in the A. On June 8th, the Georgia Professional Standards Commission unanimously voted to remove the words diversity, equity, and inclusion from the guidelines for recruiting and training public school teachers in Georgia. Apparently, the university system's Board of Regents asked the commission to remove or simplify words that in recent years have taken on multiple and different and unintended meanings. In recent years, they mean since 2020. But I am confused because what else could we possibly mean by diversity, equity, and inclusion? Instead, teachers are now contractually required to use words like different or unique. Well, now see, because words have meanings. And to say that somebody is different or unique and applying that verbiage to the Black, Indigenous, and people of color and the alphabet communities that DEI training was created for immediately suggests that white and straight is the norm. Louder for the people in the back. Oh, I ain't said that in a while. Y'all know this is a 3-year anniversary, right? Which is crazy to think that human beings who don't look like you and live the way you do is outside of the normal deviation. And while we're talking about it, talk about it now. Your norm was never even real. Everything you think about whiteness was socially constructed to exist that way. Marketing agencies turned white women into housewives with flip ends, pushing vacuums, and making potato salad with raisins in it in the 40s. Talk to them. Marketing agencies told y'all to get station wagons in the 50s. Talk to them. Hell, marketing agencies told y'all Jesus was white. Marketing agencies told y'all crack and cocaine was not the same thing. Marketing agencies told y'all Black people were subhuman. Marketing agencies told y'all this land was yours. And this land not your land. This land not my land. Y'all heifer stole it and started vibing. What? Marketing agencies told y'all white men and suits were capable, damn it. When white men in power have been putting other white men in power regardless of acumen and competency simply because it's customary. And not just because of racism, but because your forefathers saw their monarchs do it and didn't want nobody telling them what to do, but wanted some of that aristocracy for themselves. Y'all ain't never once thought for yourselves. And this homogeneity y'all came up with has been established as a norm and basis for which society has been hinged upon to maintain comfort. And now, Georgia, what? You feel that DEI has threatened that constancy for long enough? Oh, she talking today. The point of DEI is to make workplaces more culturally competent for the people who live on the margins of society to truly feel like part of the family, if that's really even the goal. To train those of us that may not experience the multiple different realities that exist other than the white ones. That despite our differences, people are entitled to inclusion, consideration, respect, and decency. But I digress. Now, aside from this being a major hindrance to the educators' abilities to teach a diverse group of students about diverse topics, this kind of mandate puts Georgia teachers between a rock and a hard place because they can't do nothing about it. At least nothing that will cause too much pressure. And why? Because Georgia is a right-to-work state, meaning teachers are prohibited from creating actual unions to protect their work environment. Well, that makes sense. No wonder we wasn't making no money. Unlike the WGA, the DGA, and SAG, ain't no strikes over here, honey. And any teacher who chooses to strike will indeed lose their job. I remember those threats in Fulton County schools during COVID. Ooh, did I say too much? So teachers either gotta get with the program or quit, which really means the kids are left with even more of a sham of an education system. And I'm left with hella questions. How are teachers who are Black or gay or disabled or non-Christian supposed to talk to their students about themselves? How will they teach their kids to interact with people who are different from them? What's gonna happen with multicultural programs and departments at schools? The CEO of Georgia Educators for Equity and Justice says that diverse teachers won't stick around if they feel psychologically unsafe in their work environments, where there isn't any training around simply how to treat people. And of course, All of this will heavily impact lower-income schools with high population of non-white kids, students with disabilities, and ESL students, all of which are already suffering from the lack of diverse, inequitable, and exclusionary gaps DEI is designed to close. I'm just saying, if all y'all strike, they can't fire all y'all. Now, going for these specific words instead of all black everything was a smart, extremist-like move. Brian Kent was smart enough to keep his name out of this, but we all know his likelihood to do dirt behind closed doors. Literally. You've been hit by, you've been struck by a smooth criminal. But sudden legislators are doing this across the board. Some very entitled white children in South Carolina just got Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates taken out of their AP class because they would feel ashamed about being white. Snitched on this lady because in South Carolina, discussing systemic racism is prohibited in school. Did you know that? No, because we've been focused on Ronald McDonald's clown ass. And a lot of y'all truly believe he's not banning books about black people. Just to name a few, examples of banned books in Florida and other states such as Texas, Utah, Missouri, and South Carolina include The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, Push by Sapphire, The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, and Genderqueer, a memoir by Maya Kobe, all of which are just about the lives of black people, queer people, or women. It just so happens that our everyday lives are so affected by and laced with oppression, and it's your fault, so don't feel bad about it. Fix it. I feel like we might owe Miss Stacey Abrams an apology. Not me, y'all.
I was truly like, am I not mic'd? And then I was just like, oh, I just suck.
Last month, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell expressed concern about Republicans' chances in the midterms, blaming candidate quality. Here to explain what he meant is Mitch McConnell and Georgia Senate candidate Herschel Walker.
Pleasure.
Yeah, let's go team, all right?
So, Herschel, you're a former NFL player.
Yes.
With no political experience.
That's right.
And you were caught lying about having three secret children.
Yes, sir.
So, Senator McConnell, do you really think this guy is ready to be a senator?
It doesn't matter what I think. It matters what I say, and I say, go, Herschel Walker.
Hey, well, I love you too, Mitch McConnick. You see, we not so different. Me and Mitch are like two peas in a bag.
All right, well... Herschel, you've already said some pretty bizarre things that they've got some Republicans worried. I mean, for example, you said, quote, our good air decided to float over to China's bad air, so when China gets our good air, the bad air got to move out. What does that mean?
Oh, Jay, I'll slow down so you can understand. We all know air, right? Air Bud.
Uh-huh, yep.
Air Jordan.
Sure.
Aaron Brockovich.
Indeed.
You see, science don't understand. Everybody talking about climate, but what we really should be focusing on is pulling Hawaii closer.
Ooh, oh, yeah.
Bring that climate over here.
That's a good idea. Yeah. I like that.
They don't need it. They little. So that's something we need to look at very, very closely. Right, Bish?
Right, it's Mitch.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Senator McConnell, I gotta ask, what qualifications does this guy actually have to be in the Senate?
Well, there's too many to name. First of all, he played football, and Georgia loves football.
Everybody loves football, baseball. In fact, man, catching balls is what makes us different from apes, okay?
That's right. That's
and
right.
Listen, if we come from apes, why are there still apes out there? Riddle me that, Obama, Michelle.
What are you talking about? Do you have any real policy proposals?
Of course I do. You know what? I wrote a few down for Mitch on the way over here. Here, go ahead. Read that there, Mitch.
Sure. Proposal number one, Barbecue Tuesday.
There it is.
Number two, let's get a daytime moon. That way, no more rain.
Boom!
And number three... Create a department of Instagram booty. Too many girls out here faking their cake.
It ain't right. It ain't right.
You know what? You know what, Herschel? Why don't you just tell them about yourself?
Oh, okay, yeah. Thank you, Stitch. I don't mind if I do. Where's my camera? Is it down here?
No, it's right there, man. It's there.
Oh, okay. Hi, America. My name is Herschel Burkett. And I play football for the U.S. Senate. Whenever I'm in hard times, I think of the strength of our founding fathers, George Carver Washington, the Jeffersons, and Benjamin Frankenstein. They changed the world when they got together and wrote the Bible. And when I'm the government, We gonna see. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. McConnell and Herschel Walker, everybody.
Yeah, we gonna be looking into that.
You know that we come from a time when it was actually super cool and super important to be smart niggas.
Nah, this era
is some other shit.
This era is some other shit.
But you know, we come from a time where, you know, Zulu Nation was strong, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the 5% nation of the gods and earths was strong, mm-hmm. and you know, that's why in hip hop they had Brand Nubian and they had X-Clan and mm-hmm. Poor Righteous Teachers and
Just Ice,
Lakim Shabazz, KRS, Public Enemy,
Goody Mob
came after that.
But I'm saying in that same vein, you know.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, back then it was important and it was cool to be smart.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And it was also accountability.
Mm-hmm.
If you. All right, so I'm gonna wear it on my sleeve. I do want to cry. You know, they told me I got 2 minutes. So, I'm gonna try. I was the youngest one in leaders of the new school and the first one to have a child. My oldest child was a 3-year-old in the Wuha video back in 96. He's 30. He's right here. I went on and I had 5 more kids after that. So I got 6 beautiful children. 5 out of the 6 of them is here. Taziah, Mariah, Casey, Takai, Trillian, and the young boss who's home, Sicario. Now, I'm saying all of this to say I was scared when Leaders of the New School broke up, because I ain't never want to be a solo MC. I ain't like the responsibility of making a full song. I'm good with getting to the 16 bars, busting everybody's ass, and getting up out of here. So I got kicked out the group, and I was scared. If y'all know, I got kicked out the group after Scenario Remix. This is 1993. I ain't put out a solo album until 96 because I was trying to figure out what I was going to do, being that I had to feed my oldest child. So Scenario was had me hot in the street at the time. And I thought that I would use this to my advantage. I knew all of the studios. I knew all of the receptionists that worked at the studios. And I would call them. Who's working in there tonight? And they would tell me. And I would go to this little weed spot. And this is pre-Northern Lights and Dro and Loud and since when it was just chocolate tie and skunk and cess and indica. So I would go to this location that we will not disclose, and I would get this chocolate tie weed, and I would get this slowest burning cigar called White Owl Cigars. And I would call these studio sessions to find out who was in them. And when I found out who was in them, I would just pop up. I knew they was going to be happy to see me anyway, because rah, rah, like a dungeon dragon was popping in the street. So I would pull up to the studio, and I would act like I was working in those studio rooms the night before, and I forgot something in there. Yeah, I left my rhyme book. I got to get something. I got to look for something. Good to see y'all. Can I come through? But I'm coming in that room, and I got my White Owl cigar of chocolate tie burning already. And I knew once I passed it to the MCs that was working in their song in that session, they couldn't kick me out. So this was my way of finding out how to feed my son. Because when leaders kicked me out, couldn't do the shows and get the show money no more. Promoters wasn't paying us for partial group to show up. Now, don't get me wrong, everything that Busta Rhymes embodies as far as going to get it and not taking no for an answer came from being a Caribbean, raised in a Jamaican home, and the same determination as leaders of the new school when we wanted to get on. I got to big up Dinko, I got to big up Brown, I got to big up Milo, because we wanted it so bad that we did anything it took to get on. With that point being said, I made sure that when my weed was moving around in that room, in that studio, I would quickly whip up a 16-bar verse before the weed came back to me. And I was able to try to do that quick enough for them dudes to want to hear my verse. And when they asked me what was I doing, I said, let me go in the booth and do it. I ain't telling you my rhyme until you let me in the booth. And I go in the booth and I spit. And come out the booth, they couldn't hear the song without the rah-rah no more. I did that 3-4 times a week. I go back to the violator office, tell Mona Scott and Chris Lighty, yo, send that invoice for $5,000. Send that one for $10,000. Send that one for $15,000. $30,000-$40,000 a week. I ain't got to split it up with nobody in the group. I like that. Long story short, by default, I pioneered the feature. I'm running out of time. But one more thing. A lot of greatness from our people and our culture is by default, because it's just a magic that we have. You ain't never seen a black caveman, right? You ain't never seen a black caveman, right? Okay, cool. So with that, I'm gonna say, I just am grateful that the blessing that has been bestowed upon me and this gift that I've been given and this fire that continues to burn as a passion in my soul that allows me to get in any situation from the stage to collabing with whoever and making sure that I am far from the weak link, because I enjoy walking away from a situation saying, I bust ass. It's just me trying to do my duty to continue to advance the culture and continue to contribute in a significant way. I see so many people in here that I've known and I've grown with for a long time, and y'all watch me grow, and I love y'all, and I know y'all love me, but I'm a real giver of love. Sometimes I know I might overwhelm you. I want to hug you, and I won't let you go. I shake your hand. I shake it tight. I speak to you from a place. I really want you to know that I really want you to know I mean what I'm saying. You know what I'm saying? I gotta say this. I gotta say this. There's nothing that I do that's as great as I do it without my brother Split Star. I love you so much. My best friend. My other best friend, DJ Scratch and Tour, we all grew up in East Flatbush, Brooklyn before we went to Long Island. I think I had enough. I really wish I could keep talking this. It took so long to give me this. I got so much to say. Mommy, I love you so much. Thank you for signing my deal when I was 17 at Elektra Records. Sylvia Rhone came over there, changed my life. Put your hands, woo-ha, everything remains raw. We was busting ass. Sylvia Rhone means so much to me. Mona Scott, you mean so much to me. Sylvia went to Universal. She left Warner. She brought me over there, took me with her. She went to Epic. I'm back with her. We just dropped an incredible record 2 days ago called Beach Ball with me and Bia. It's the anthem for the summer. Now, one thing that I need y'all to know, we're going to stop these little petty beefs that we be doing in rap. This shit is... Y'all messing up the bag. Y'all messing up the energy. I don't like when I talk to these dudes that run these streaming platforms and they talking about, you know, we turning the consumer off because there's so much little this and little that going on with you rappers. We're going to stop that. We're going to love each other. And we're going to get to this money. You know, executives, start promoting everything that can be great in the music, too. It ain't just got to be about the ass shaking and the, how much drugs we sold and how much dudes we tied up, how much drugs we doing. You know what I'm saying? I'm from the Chuck D era and the Kane era, but I'm a timeless great. I rock with all of my new artists. Everything about me is leading the new. That's why my group was called Leaders of the New. Shout out to every new artist that's contributing and doing their job. I love seeing Ice Spice. I love seeing Coi Leray. I love seeing Kendrick. I love seeing J. Cole. I love seeing Wu-Tang. I love seeing Nas. We're going to stop this narrative like we don't love each other. This divide thing. It's corny. It's tired. It's whack. What's really happening is they scared for us to get together. We might give y'all too much information. But we ain't going nowhere. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to tell you one thing that I loved about the OGs on my block. They might have went to jail when I was 10. And I'm 20 years old and maybe I'm still a knucklehead now and I'm on the block trying to hustle like them. They come home when they 30. And they come back to the block acting like, yo, young boy, let me show you how to do this. And then the young boy say, of course, OG. You know we salute you, OG. But then the OG don't want to listen to the young boy. But he trying to tell the young boy what to do, but he don't look the part. He don't smell the part. He don't live the part no more. How you expect the young G to listen to you? You still got to look the part. You still got to be the part. Because you don't want the young G to say, hey, yo, OG, you telling me how to do something, but it don't look like it worked for you no more. We looking good. A lot of us OGs look good. It's important. We want y'all to pull up and we want to give you the information. Because when I needed it, Kane let me come to his crib, his million-dollar crib in Jamaica States. EPMD used to let me come to their crib way out in the Suffolk County area and see all of their real estate. Chuck D used to sit me down and give me the jewels. I got the jewels. I got the arm put around me to school me and show me how to be groomed and well-raised, learn what to do, and take it and apply it and do it, secure the win. Y'all got to do that now. And we're going to do it with y'all because we still busting ass.
Well, hello.
Hey, this is Mike Nelson, formerly of Mystery Science Theater 3000 until I got fired. You're listening to WRCT 88.3 FM, which is a heck of a lot better than having the top of your head sawed off and having vinegar poured in.
We don't want you on our team. You're too slow and fat.
This is weight bias.
Don't you care how you look?
Those with the serious disease called obesity face weight bias every day.
You're not the right fit for this job.
And blame themselves.
I wish I was different.
Weight bias hurts.
Let's stop weight bias.
Be part of the solution.
Go to stopweightbias.com. A public service message from Obesity Action Coalition.
Listening to WRCT, Pittsburgh. And you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM, also broadcasting online at WRCT.org. My name is Steve, your host for the Deep Blues Hour, 60 minutes of classic and traditional blues. And in this hour, we're going to hear from a couple of bigs. Yeah, Big Joe Williams and Big Bill Brunzi. Can't beat all the big gentlemen in the house tonight. Also hear from Jesse Fuller, plus a little something from Earl Hooker, who we're hearing from right now, but we'll hear something a bit more lengthy a little bit later towards the end of the program. Stick around, a couple of bigs, a Jesse and an Earl. It's all here on the Deep Blues Hour. I'm going to start off, though, with Paul Butterfield and his blues band from his original Lost Electra sessions. This is Nut Popper Number 1 from 1964. Paul Butterfield here on the Deep Blues Hour. Row House Cinema joins you in supporting WRCT. Row House Cinema is a single-screen theater in the historic Lawrenceville neighborhood of Pittsburgh. Each week, they choose a new movie theme showing classic, cult, foreign, animation, fun, and fascinating films in a magical setting. Their concession stand features natural popcorn with real butter, craft beer, and vegan options. Row House Cinema is located at 4115 Butler Street in Lawrenceville. For more information, visit their website at rowhousecinema.com or call 412-904-3225.